From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. Well, it's been a week of big news. President Obama outlined his gun safety agenda, including 23 executive orders and new proposals to step up background checks and limit the size of magazines. But the NRA, not so happy. And Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick laid out his agenda, calling for more taxes and more money for transportation and education. Plus, as you just heard breaking news, Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray looks to be bowing out of the governor's race. Meanwhile, fallout continues from the heartbreaking suicide of online activist and Reddit co-founder Aaron Swartz, who faces fines and jail time for illegally downloading millions of academic articles. And last night, yes, we all watched it, Lance Armstrong came clean about doping, finally, in an interview with Oprah Winfrey. Joining me to talk about all these stories and a whole lot more, Michael Goldman, president of the political communications consulting firm Goldman Associates, Jennifer Nassour, former Massachusetts Republican Party chair, and Joan Vanacki, columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Big news week. So let's start with the president and what he put out in terms of gun control. Let's first listen to him at his news conference on Wednesday saying he's going to fight to get gun control laws in place.
And in the days ahead, I intend to use whatever weight this office holds to make them a reality. Because while there is no law or set of laws that can prevent every senseless act of violence completely, no piece of legislation that will prevent every tragedy, every act of evil, if there is even one thing we can do to reduce this violence, if there's even one life that can be saved, then we've got an obligation to try.
Michael Goldman, the president said, look, in the month since Sandy Hook, just a month, more than 900 Americans have died from gunshots. Does he have a chance here at changing laws?
I would say to you, you can even take it and bigger than that. If you take a look from the beginning of our country in 1776 through today, about 1.4 million Americans have died in all our wars. In the 44 years since Robert Kennedy was killed in June of 1968, Kara, 44 years, 1.6 million people have been killed by guns, more than in every war in American history. If that isn't a call to some sort of epidemic of gun violence, I don't know what is. What's really fascinating to me is the polling that appears to be coming out now that separates the members of the NRA from the NRA leadership. They seem to be much more willing to make changes than the leadership does. And the real question is politically, and again, it'll be interesting, you know, for Jen and Joan, you know, the question is, are they going to lose their membership because they're unwilling to make any of the kinds of changes that even the members think make sense?
You know, Jennifer Nassour, I wonder, you know, what do you see happening? I mean, and to what Michael Goldman said, there does seem to be some movement in the polls. We see now 54% of people in the U.S. think that gun control laws should be tougher. You look back in April, it was 39%. It's not a huge, huge shift, but it's a sizable shift. Does the president have a chance of changing anything?
Well, I think, first of all, if you look at Chicago, right, it's the president's hometown, where there's gun violence every single minute of every single day. When we look at that, extra gun laws are not going to stop that type of gun violence, because that's not Joan and Michael, myself, you. If we go out, we're going to get a license. We're going to use it in a manner that we got the gun for. You can't strip people of their Second Amendment rights. I think what has to be done, and where the NRA would be very smart, is to sit down with members of Congress and with the president and say, okay, listen, we understand that there's a problem out there. We do want to come up with solutions to fix it. We have law-abiding citizens who use guns at shooting ranges or to go hunting or just because they want one to feel safe in their home. We have an epidemic of people who have mental illness, and we have let all those people go they're not taken care of. They're running around out there, and they get hold of guns. How can we fix this? How can we make these laws better?
When you saw the press conference with President Obama, with Vice President Biden, did you feel like they were starting to strip some of those Second Amendment rights away?
Yeah, because I don't think that the president should unilaterally decide that he's going to make 23 executive orders and take it out of Congress's control. I think that that's really a immature way to handle it. I think that more maturely would be to sit down with our elected representatives and say, we need to do something about this. You see what happened in Newtown. We can't let that happen again. We have little babies. I myself am a parent of a little six-year-old. It brings me to tears every single time I think of those kids and those parents and those little siblings. However, I think we need to have mature conversations. The NRA isn't being mature about it, and neither is the president.
Joan Bernanke.
Well, I guess I would quibble with the use of the word mature. I think the president did what needed to be done. In this country, you need to, seize the moment before attention passes. And a month is about when attention usually passes. And I think he spoke quite honestly when he said, I'm going to use whatever power I can that this office holds. And the 23 executive orders, as he said, don't really substantially change things. The NRA is, an issue, but so are Democrats in the Senate. I mean, Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, has an A rating from the NRA, and I think they helped him win re-election last time around. So, it'll be interesting to see if President Obama can rally his own party behind him.
Kara, because I want to go back to something Jen said. When President Bush, George W. Bush, did his executive orders implementing faith-based initiatives, I didn't hear Republicans saying it's an abuse of executive power. The reality is John Tyler, when he became president, acted as a president, and the Congress went to the Supreme Court way back in 1841 and said, does the president have the power as administrator to do these executive orders? And the Supreme Court 165 years ago, 70 years, said yes. So this is not something new. And as Joan pointed out, they're not huge things, but they're small pieces of business. The most famous executive order ever was in 1948 when, on his own, basically with no support, Harry Truman said, I'm going to integrate the Army. It was a gutsy thing to do. I think the president deserves credit. I wish he could have done more.
Let's get to some of the actual specifics that the president proposes. There were executive orders, but a lot of the controversial stuff is going to have to go through Congress. And here are some of the more controversial things that he wants to try to do. Get rid of armor-piercing bullets, have a ban on assault weapons, which is certainly a real controversy, a 10-round limit on magazines, get mental health professionals better trained, have the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, start to study gun violence again. There's been a freeze on that, and strengthen background checks. And Jennifer Nassour, do those things sound to you like, outside what Republicans could support?
No, I think that's something, again, that if he went to Congress and he said, these are the things that I'm looking to do. I think that mental health is something that absolutely we should be looking at.
But how about the ban on assault weapons? How about a 10-round limit on magazines?
Well,
some of the things are going to be tougher.
I think that ultimately when you have give and take and the Republicans sit down and they have to look at that. And even to Joan's point, some of the Democrats who are, NRA supporters, Harry Reid, has been out there. But I would say, they're going to look and say, okay, well, maybe 10 rounds isn't so bad. A ban on the assault rifles. I think that there's a better way for them. They could sit down and come to the table with something that says, why don't we put where assault weapons can be only used with fingerprints, or you need a code like we have in our iPhones and our iPads, and then at least start the conversation on what to do with them. It's hard to pull them off the streets because people, or not off the streets, but legal gun owners do have them, and they use them at ranges, and they use them in a very responsible manner. So I think that that's something that Republicans maybe could work within some parameters where they're not offending and upsetting their constituency, but they're doing something that really is responsible.
I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio on WGBH, and we're talking about the news of the week with Michael Goldman, Jennifer Nassour, and Joan Vernachie. And Joan Vernachie, it's interesting because in the president's news conference about this, he actually cited Ronald Reagan saying we need to get rid of assault weapons. But I wonder, is that possible? I mean, we talked about Harry Reid, Joe Manchin from West Virginia. I mean, there are going to be even Democrats who are going to say, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, as far as I'm concerned with me, he's preaching to the choir. I mean, I see no need to have assault weapons, you know, on the streets or, you know, in your closets or, you know, anywhere, quite honestly. I don't see where the Second Amendment gives people that right. It's going to take like a real, I guess, you know, advertising effort, a real political campaign. It's going to take poll numbers that show lawmakers, you know, to give them the courage to do what, you know, what I think should be done. Well, if it happens, I don't know. I guess I'd be surprised. I think the power of the NRA has been proven time and time again. And to stand up to that organization seems to take more spine than a lot of legislators have.
One point that I really agree with Jen on, however, is her original comment on Chicago. And the truth is one of the huge problems with guns that the president hasn't addressed, and none of this addressed, is there are so many guns out there, mega millions of guns. So many of them are stolen each and every year, and they become the guns of crime. And again, it's mind-boggling to think that you can get caught with 40 pounds of heroin in Antigua in a plane, and you get 10 years in jail. And if you get caught with an illegal handgun, you go away for 30 years. Absolute. I mean, that's why they don't have any guns in Antigua, because they think that's worse than a humongous amount of drugs. We don't have that psyche here, and so, as Joan points out, it's hard for me to imagine that AK-47s do anything other than kill people, or cop killer bullets do anything but kill cops. But I think we're going to make some progress. I think it's going to be the first progress we've made in a long time. But it won't be what I want, certainly. But it'll be more than we got right now.
Well, one of the things that's sort of surfaced in the last few weeks is the amount of gun violence in the U.S. compared to economically comparable countries. We have 8 times higher gun violence than economically comparable countries. And I think one thing that is perplexing is certainly those other countries have people with mental health problems and they watch, you know, violent movies and play video games. So it can't be different there, but that doesn't seem to have penetrated as an argument.
Well, Joan, go ahead.
Go ahead, Michael. You can
I was just going to say that Joan made a point about saying about the,
remind me of it.
Yeah, the point that she made just a second ago about the fact that we haven't really studied this the way we should. As a matter of fact, the Republican administration, for their own reasons, decided not to look at these issues. And what you really kind of looking at, to your point, is there is a need to do what we did over a 40-year period with tobacco, which is to simply start the long process of education. For example, you are far more likely to die of a gun in a home that you have as a safety item than you would if you live in a house without a gun, allegedly not being protected. Now, that's something people need to know over and over. They could still make the decision to keep the gun, but that's going to give people pause. If we don't give them good research, then they're going to just say that doesn't make any sense. I don't care what the, quote, experts say.
Right. You have to come up with some sort of campaign that counters the conventional wisdom and convinces people that it's in their greater good. I mean, usually, you know, when the other side stands up there and says, oh, that won't work, it didn't work before, I mean, you have to sort of counter it with facts and information that changes the public mindset.
Just one quick thing. You know, first of all, let's not hit the Republican administration, because this administration has already been in for, you know, it's going on its second term. So this is something that Obama could have been working at.
Absolutely.
You know, again, most violence in the country
Agreed
is in Chicago.
Yes.
They could have been working on it. Okay, let's not hit the Republicans. We've taken enough bashing this year. My second thing is that, unlike smoking, having guns is a Second Amendment right. And so people are going to, I think the research absolutely needs to be there. I think, but But again, it's going to be how many teenagers do you still see out there smoking? How many schools do you walk by and, you know, within 100 feet of the school, kids are walking by, they're still smoking down the streets of Boston, still happening. No matter how much research is out there, it's still going to be there. I think it's fantastic to have. But, you know, I think, again, it's coming to people who are really legitimately touching those constituents and talking with the NRA and coming up with a better strategy of letting people understand what happens.
Well, each generation has to be re-educated. I mean, the push against cigarette smoking is now several decades old. When we were growing up, I do see young people smoking, and I wonder, you know, shouldn't we, sort of reinvent the campaigns to remind them of the dangers.
And I would also, and just last final point, I would just say, I would remind people who are listening that for a long time, owning a gun was not an absolute right. A Supreme Court made a decision, which I think is wrong. I think when Obama gets an opportunity to have a 5-4 court, that will be overturned. So that's sort of a very nebulous thing, because for 260 years, that was not the law of the land.
Let's look actually at some of the backlash. In fact, on The Daily Show last night, Jon Stewart gave viewers a taste of both the president's press conference surrounded by kids and the right-wing response to that and the backlash against the proposals. Let's listen.
Not only was Obama guilty of executive overreach, yesterday Obama was guilty of executive overdramatization.
Using children just raises the emotional hackles.
I find it despicable. Just deal with this on a rational, intellectual level, and let's see if the debate merits itself out.
Okay.
First of all, yes. That was some manipulative political bull right there. That was some stagecraft, no question, which I think, you know, you can argue about and begrudge, especially when the right's been trying so hard to maintain a rational and logical dialogue about guns. Remember?
If he does executive orders, he's becoming more like Hugo Chavez.
Like Hitler, like Stalin, like Mao.
Fidel Castro took the guns.
Germany, it happened to the Germans. French, it happened in China.
Italy,
it happened in Uganda.
Spain,
I mean,
Japan.
He's
even using children. It reminds me of Saddam Hussein when he used kids.
Wow!
Jenna Renessour from the Republican Party, do you get a sense that there is panic? I mean, this comparison of President Obama to Hitler to Stalin to Mao, is there panic in some quarters on the right?
I mean, you know, we're on a radio show, right? It makes for good publicity out there for talk show hosts. I don't think that there's this mass hysteria. I think that there are more rational people than irrational people. And I think there are a lot of good people out there that want to see especially kids protected. You know, the gang violence, our kids, the little boy that was shot last week walking to choir practice, 13 years old, minding his own business, you know, and going to choir practice. How bad of a kid could he have been? I think rational people want to see things change and they want to see movement. But any type of radical, dramatic movement gets people all flustered. And again, I think that taking control of a situation by oneself and not allowing people who we elect to office to have a say in it also causes some mass hysteria.
Is there hysteria, Michael Goldman, do you think?
Well, I think that there is, and I think that it's silly. Again, I always go back to the past because I always like to see history in retrospect.
It's just your age.
It's true, you know. But when I think back, when I look at the stuff again, and I use the 1948 integration of the Army, the only place the Army was integrated in America was in Hollywood. And when I see statistics that showed 95% of white people and 90% of black people in 1948 opposed integrating the Army because it would never work, and that the president had the guts to stand up against his own party, it was a Southern Democrat, same kind of thing we're talking about here with gun Democrats and guns. Sometimes you got to just figure there's a moment in time, and I'm just going to try. And you know, if he fails, at least he can walk away saying, I didn't have a second term, like the first term when he did nothing on guns, which is just, it's just horrific.
Well, I love Jon Stewart. I think he's a genius, brilliant, funny, all that stuff. But until he gets a slot on Fox, I mean, he's preaching to a liberal choir, you know, himself. You know, I think it's wrong to say there's hysteria. I think the NRA thinks that money and time will do what it always does and that this will recede. I hope they're wrong, but, you know, over time, they've proven to be stronger than the most emotional pull.
I think one question is that people are asking, is this a time where things have changed? We saw just in the last few days, NBC and the Wall Street Journal release a new poll showing people's views of the Republican Party, which in all the time they've been doing this poll are at an all-time low, 49% negative, 26% positive, 25% neutral or don't know. Which is interesting because clearly some people who either feel neutral or negatively then about the Republican Party vote Republican, right? Because half the country votes Republican. So what's going on here? Is this tied into the gun debate?
Well, I think it will be interesting to see how certain players on the national stage what they do with this gun issue. Now in New York, Andrew Cuomo, who most people seem to think is sort of positioning himself to maybe make a presidential run.
Right, the current governor.
Right, has, come out strong for gun control laws and put some into effect just this week. In New Jersey, Chris Christie, I believe, has had some positive comments about what Obama, not only about Hurricane Sandy,
right,
but also about gun control. So I think the Republicans, you tell me, Jennifer, seem to be trying to figure this out and see if what the polls are showing is something really solid and lasting, and that they have to respond to it. And you'll see the ones that are positioning themselves for the next go round do that if they think it's politically in their interests.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with John. I don't think that it's just guns. I think that, overall, the party has a negative image just because or not such a positive image because of, our message, our crafting of our message, our messengers that have been out there. And I think right now you see a lot of leaders who are normally out front who have kind of stepped back a little bit, and people are kind of sitting in rooms, I think, trying to talk and figure out where the party is going. And so I think the gun issue is one of those issues. I think a lot of the other social issues are another part of it.
Is there a way to transition the Republican Party from the numbers now, which are tough, to something that's more positive so that, in 2014, they'll be ready to really take on Democrats?
I think so. I definitely think that there is, because I think that there are a lot of younger leaders out there who really can step up to the plate. And for them, everything is a learning curve, right? Because they're in their late 30s and early 40s, and they've had an opportunity to kind of come up the ranks knowing what they know. But if you look at a Nikki Haley or a Marco Rubio or a Susana Martinez, where they're now in office, and now they can actually listen to their constituency, they can see what's actually going on. And I think that they have an opportunity to be able to start to change with their views based on their age and their surroundings. I think for some of the older members of the party, I think it's time for them to kind of step aside and let these newer, younger folks get in and start crafting that message. And so I think that we will have an opportunity in 14.
Michael Goldman, I wonder if part of it is that, look, Nate Silver has said in the New York Times, in 1992, there were 103 House districts that we could call swing districts, right? There are now 35. And we just keep redrawing the line so that everybody basically feels safe where they are.
Right. And it's the worst thing that's happened to democracy, I think, in my lifetime. And that's a big statement to make. I want to slide back just a little bit on that point to Jen's point. I've said publicly before, not to embarrass Jen, that while we probably disagree on 98% of the issues, I think that the party that can take her and people like her, and we mentioned some of the names, certainly Chris Christie and I disagree on a ton of things, but his independence from this sort of crazy right-wing extremist. I mean, we're seeing it in the Republican Party now in the battle over who should be the party chair. You've got the party activists who simply are out of step, even with Republicans. So how the heck can you get good candidates when the party, and I saw that happen to the Democratic Party, my party, in 72, when the McGovern people were out of step with Democrats, a huge portion of the Democratic Party. And when that happens, you'll start to see the Republicans coming back. Until then, I think Chris Christie is the best thing that happened to the Republicans just because he seems to be unafraid of Rush Limbaugh and Fox News. He's going to say what he says. And you know what? I like a guy who's willing to say when the president's right, he's with him. Then when he says the president's wrong, I'm going to say, he basically gave the president his chops on. So again,
Absolutely.
Not to.
I think a person who could have something to say in this debate about the direction of the Republican Party, and Michael, maybe you'll laugh at this, is Mitt Romney. Who had more to lose than
where
what,
is Mitt
what,
Romney?
I don't know. He's fallen off the face.
Disneyland is where he is.
Oh, okay.
Had a very rough December, but. You know, think about the gun issue. He got behind the assault weapons ban in Massachusetts, yet he had to abandon that position along with many other positions because of, you know, the right wing of the Republican Party forced him away from that. He could have been a voice of reason on so many issues, and that wing of the party, you know, would not allow it. If he wanted to step into a debate like this and play a role, he could. I don't know if he has any interest in it, but
yeah, no, you're right. I mean, that's an awesome point, Joan. And you know, unfortunately, I don't know where he's at right now, and he's probably still sitting there scratching his head on what happened.
Well, if you're at Disneyland right now and you see him, call in. I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH Boston Public Radio, and I'm talking with Joan Vernocchi, columnist for the Boston Globe, Jennifer Nessor, former Massachusetts Republican Party chair, and Michael Goldman, president of Goldman Associates. And let's talk a little bit now about somebody who's certainly been on the national stage, Governor Deval Patrick. Gave his State of the State this week, and let's hear just a little clip from it. He's talking about his rationale for a push to raise taxes.
I know just as clearly as possible how tough the times have been on the people and families of our Commonwealth. And though the worst of the recession is over, many, many families still face tough decisions and have deep anxiety about the future. I would not ask if I did not believe in my heart that investing meaningfully today in education and transportation will significantly improve our economic tomorrow.
Joan Vernocchi, could you tell that this was somebody who didn't have to run for re-election?
Oh, gosh, you just took my line away.
Oh, I mean, okay, sorry about that.
I was there. It was a great speech. You know, shivers up and down the spine. No, nobody's better than Deval Patrick when he's on. He's a great campaigner. He's, you know, gotten really passionate with his, you know, rhetoric and all that. But this is a speech given by a governor who is on his way out, and the burden of the vote is on the legislators who do not want to leave Beacon Hill. So it will be interesting to see if he can spin them enough. I don't know.
Is he going to be able to spin
them
enough?
I've got three, quick points. First of all, everyone complains about taxes, and yet most of Massachusetts seems to be can't wait to go to slot machines and casinos to spend the money they claim they don't have for taxes. They are totally broke, except when the casino opens, in which case they have plenty of additional dollars. I think that the way – I agree that this was the governor's best speech I ever heard. But I think you need to make the point – the two points I would say is a safe society has to mean more than police and fire. A safe society has to mean bridges and tunnels and aqueducts not falling down. And the fact is that Democrats and Republicans both have put off our infrastructure forever, and we can't afford to keep it going much longer. And someone's got to pay for that, either me or my kids or my kids' kids. The second part is the more we educate, everyone agrees, the more we educate the poorest populations of our Commonwealth, the more likely that they will be financially able to not use government services. So in the long run, if we look at welfare in the long run, if you can get a kid an education so that they have a job, then they don't go on. So that there is a big picture piece here that you can make for this investment. Now, Joan hit it perfectly, and that is the reality is people want to get reelected, and voting for taxes is never easy. I would have loved to have heard this speech be the first speech that he gave the first year that he was in office. You know,
that would have been real political courage.
That would have been terrific. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't start to have a serious discussion, particularly about one of the things on our list today was the tunnel. I mean, we cannot have an infrastructure where every time you go over a bridge, you wonder whether it's one of the 60% of the bridges that are about to fall down.
Right.
I mean,
we've got them taking all the reflective panels down, thousands of them. Right. So
that's one lousy tunnel out of thousands of tunnels.
Jennifer Nestor, he started the State of the State with this reference to Orchard Garden School in Roxbury, and he used the kids that were there as a sort of jumping off point to talk about his own path through Milton, and he talks about Harvard. So is he doing something effective in trying to sell, yeah, a tax hike?
No, I don't think it's ever. I don't ever think a tax hike is in order, especially when we're still in the middle of a recession, especially when unemployment, you know, went up again, especially when businesses are out there saying that it's still a pretty tough environment, especially when you still see storefronts that are empty and vacant. I just don't think it's time for a tax hike of this magnitude. This is the highest tax hike number one in state history. Number two, I don't really know that if $1.8 billion being spent on the South Coast Railway that this is the exact time that we should be doing it. Number three, you know, we have lots of holes in our roof right now in our house. And I think that instead of saying, oh, you know, it would be great on this house is adding an addition. So why don't we put the addition on? Those holes, we'll just stick some scotch tape up there and it'll be fine until the next rainstorm. I'm sorry, we can't wait until the next rainstorm. So, yes, you know, education is so important for everyone. However, we haven't taken care of yet the real reforms. We haven't gotten rid of the real fraud. We haven't seen where those internet sales with Amazon being taxed, where that revenue is going to fill in some gaps. And, you know, I think before we start creating new projects, we need to take care of the ones that we have and we need to manage those. We have the biggest biggest budget ever at $32.5 billion. That's a serious amount of money. I was reading somewhere, I think it went up it's a billion more than we spent last year and 17% more than was spent during his first year in office.
But if the things that he was proposing were just reinforcing things instead of, as you say, adding new projects, like let's say making sure the MBTA runs better, not a new line, but just better. Did that feel like something you could get behind?
Well, you know, I think there was an interesting article in the Herald the other day by Charlie Chipio and Jim Sturgis. And they said, how about a modest tax modest hike in the gas tax, right? Because that is something that we all pay and it's a little bit more palatable. But when you're taxing income tax and that affects 50% of Massachusetts residents, that's not the top 1%. That's 50% of residents that's going to hurt. So that's going to hurt the person who's making $60,000, $80,000. That's a big thing. Now, let me also point something. My one last point that I'd like to make is that Governor Patrick was really mad when Charlie Baker said that he's going to get into office and he's going to hike up your income tax. And he said, I never said that. And he campaigned on not raising taxes. And then what does he do when right after the president is elected, he doesn't have to be on the stump anymore for the president. He is almost done with his term. And he now just leaves it up to the legislators and leaves them in the line of fire is he goes and he raises income taxes.
Well, as usual, I'm going to be somewhere right in the middle. I think, you know, I'm guessing that you know, when you put out a giant number like $1.9 billion, you know that you're not going to get all of that in taxes. And that if you've got the Pioneer Institute, Jim Sturgios, you know, saying that they can get behind some sort of modest tax increase, and there has been other voices in the business community expressing support for it, that something, you know, there's some consensus there that can be reached. In terms of kinds of taxes, I'm no tax expert, but I think increase in the income tax is considered more progressive than a hike in the gas tax, shared more broadly by different income levels versus more of a disproportionate burden on the lower income.
And so, I should say specifically, he's saying, let's bring up the income tax from 5.25 to 6.25%, and let's bring down the sales tax from 6.25 to 4.5. So there's a couple of different moving pieces there.
I do think the politics are really interesting, and Michael can help me out on this one, but it's, you know, if this tax hike goes through, you know, any kind of tax hike goes through, it's perfect for the Republican who's going to be campaigning against the Democrat who is not Deval Patrick. It is a very strong reminder of what happened when Michael Dukakis was leaving office. Dukakis and the Democrats and the legislature passed a big tax hike. Bill Weld ran against it, Massachusetts, horrible things. Then he won. And boy, did he benefit from that new revenue.
Absolutely.
So
great.
Charlie Baker, I'll be interested. I'd like to hear what Charlie Baker has to say about the taxes. He'll probably be dead set against it. But boy, will he be happy if that revenue's there
well,
for him.
You know who else is going to be happy? All of the Republicans who are planning to run against all the Democrats in 2014 and say, look who voted for the tax increase. One other thing on that, on the tax increase, is that it baked in there in the paper today. It was saying that one of the deductions that's going to be lost is the deduction on dependents under 12 years old. Now, as a parent of three kids under 12 years old, that stinks. And for all you parents out there that have little kids, guess what? That stinks for every single one of us.
Again, I've got to just, you know, to sort of finish this.
Bring it over to the left here.
Yeah. I just want to say, Republicans, even my friend Jen, love to talk about how it hurts people. No one ever says how it helps people that a bridge doesn't fall on your head or that a kid gets educated who isn't getting educated now. And so there's a benefit as well as a downside to that. The worst thing in my career was watching Bill Weld run in 1990. Joan alluded to it. Governor Dukakis came in with a $12 billion budget. It was a larger, believe it or not, Jen, a larger tax increase than this one, $2 billion. Weld ran across the state and said, I am not going to give you a $12 billion tax increase budget. My budget's going to be $11 billion. I'm going to cut all the waste and the fat. And I'm going to give back every single dime of the tax increase that the Democrats passed. In 1991, his budget came in. It wasn't $12 billion. It was $13 billion, and he used every dime of that tax money. And then he went out, and when he had an opportunity for the first time ever to have a balanced budget, to go out and say, now we can start to do things, he did everything he could to say, I'm never going to raise a tax again. And we're back in here. It's 20 years later. We're facing the same crisis that we had. It's like nothing ever changes because there's no political will to fight the fight when you need to fight it.
That's because our governor and our whole legislature is all on one party, and they haven't done anything about it in the past.
In fairness, for 16 years, the Republicans were in charge of the governors.
No, but wait a second. At the end of the day, it's the House and the Senate, and they agree or they disagree, and they can come out in full force, and they haven't. So stop putting it on Republicans. We've never been in charge of this state. It's been, 60 years?
Who proposes? The governor.
Yeah, but the House and the Senate can vote it down.
Michael Goldman, I'm wondering your take on the notion. We just saw a pretty contested Senate election. We may see another one pretty soon, but we just saw a pretty contested Senate election, and Elizabeth Warren did really quite well. And she was certainly not a tax cutter. So I wonder if something has changed, maybe we were talking about this before, maybe in the National Republican Party, that has poisoned the well a little bit for Republicans in Massachusetts, made it so that people like Scott Brown, who are, frankly, in the National Republican Party, extremely moderate, makes it hard for him to run in Massachusetts.
It goes to another subject we had hoped we'd get to, probably we won't, which is the governor's fight, and that is where I think I could make the case that he would have an easier time running for governor as a moderate candidate, although the Democrats would try to make him not moderate, obviously, but as a moderate, than he does having to carry the load of Washington Republicans who are out of step with him, let alone with the people of Massachusetts. So your point is really well taken there, but I do think that. This debate over taxes is as old as America. When the Whig Party was formed, the original Republican Party was formed essentially because we had a fight over the infrastructure of the country. Should there be federal roads and bridges? And Jacksonian Democrats said, you know, the federal government shouldn't be paying for roads and bridges. And Lincoln and the Republicans and the business community said, you can't grow the country unless we start to expand our ability to get goods to the marketplace. So the tax issue and the issue of how you make it and grow that's as old as the country. And no one likes taxes ever.
Joe Vernacki, you want to get in here?
I'm not as old as Michael Goldman, so I don't remember what Lincoln had to say. I'm sorry. But to bring
that's
it back.
So hard to be the oldest person in the room. I know.
Elizabeth Warren won, I think, in large measure because she ran against the national Republican agenda. That's why, I agree with Michael in that I think it's going to be harder for Scott Brown to run for Senate again. And even though I wrote a column saying that Bill Weld would not be a wise choice to run for Senate for the Republicans, I don't know. I may rethink that. One thing about Bill Weld is he's known to be he's liberal on all the social issues.
A libertarian on all the social issues.
You know, he's an alleged fiscal conservative, but not draconian. And that might be, I mean, no one's going to think that he's going to go to Washington and, you know, fold in the face of Mitch McConnell or that gang.
Yeah, that would be a tough picture to paint.
I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH Boston Public Radio. And I want to, in our last few minutes here before the break, switch gears a little bit and talk about Aaron Swartz, who I know that you have written about, Joan. And I, on Wednesday, I talked to Bettina Neuefeind, who is head of the Legal Defense Fund for Aaron Swartz. She's also married to Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig, who has been very vocal in his support of Aaron Swartz, who, I should say, killed himself in the wake of a case that was accusing him of downloading more than 4 million documents from the online archive JSTOR. And she talked on Wednesday about how deeply engaged he was in his activism. Let's listen.
He really set about making systemic change and started working politically and as a political activist. And you know, we worked, he was a board member at Change Congress, and he worked at the Ethics Center at Harvard on institutional corruption issues and started Demand Progress. And, you know, he was really, really sort of active on all possible fronts and had his sights set perpetually onward.
Joan Vanacki, I mean, here's somebody who almost everybody says was a genius, but you know, at his funeral, his father said essentially that he believes the government killed him. What's your view here?
Well, I'm not going to sort of challenge what a grieving father says. I'm the mother of a 23-year-old son who's not a computer prodigy, but you know, I certainly have, you know, nothing but sympathy for, you know, the family. And I have a lot of sort of sympathy and empathy for the idea of civil disobedience and the need to bring about systemic change. But I guess I just also, you know, believe that if you knowingly break a law, the law can be wrong, the law can be unjust, that, you know, you have to understand and accept that certain consequences might flow. This one sounds like it needs to be changed. And I also just, you know, the thing about this case that, you know, that sort of interests me is, what does it take to get people outraged about the way prosecutors do their job? Do you have to be a genius? Do you have to be connected to the Harvard community? I mean, there are a lot of people that get, you know, dragged into federal court who probably shouldn't be there, and they would just never get, you know, the platform. So I you know, that sort of influenced me in my writing, knowing that it's you know, that there are, it's really emotional and there's a lot of controversy involved in how the U.S. attorney went a better job in this case.
Michael Goldman, we've talked a lot about history today. It has struck me in looking at this case that in a lot of ways, the sort of hacker community that Aaron Swartz was a part of feels like a continuation of something that we saw in the 1960s and 70s, this question over what the government is entitled to have, even when the government says, look, we are entitled to make these kinds of decisions. Should information be free? Should things be free that, you know, look, if they're not free, we're going to liberate them.
Yeah, I do have that same sense of this. It's very funny. I hadn't thought of it, you know, just till now. And as you started to say it, I said, oh, my God, that's exactly what I've been feeling. I think that Joan, though, hit the very interesting part of this is, why has this touched a chord? We happen to disagree on, you know, whether the U.S. attorney did or didn't overstep. And people, rational people, can disagree. I happen to think that they did. But I think that what this really is exactly what you're talking about. There's a sense out there that the government is wrong on this one, and that as the whole communications model of my life starts to really evaporate around me, when I start thinking about the Tao story, which we haven't talked about, mm-hmm. thank goodness, and I heard about all this stuff that I never knew existed. You could be on the phone and Skype and do all kinds of things. I have no technical skill, whatever. I barely can still pick up my messages from voicemail. And I realize around me has been this revolution that's taken place. And I haven't even seen it coming, Kara. It's so overwhelming to me as a communications person to not get this stuff. And that community is fighting the fights that I think really legitimately the government has to start to say, maybe we're wrong on this stuff. And again, should he have paid a fine? Probably. Should he have gone to jail? come on. I mean, it's. I mean, we're talking. You know, we don't have room for drug dealers and rapists and murderers. This is kind of silly to me. But again, you know, people could disagree with that.
He stole something.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. At the end of the day, listen. I'm a lawyer. Okay. I cannot say that she was wrong. Her job, prosecutors' jobs, are to prosecute at the fullest extent of the law. The job of the defense counsel is to get you out of those charges. So his lawyer never was saying, his lawyer was saying, well, on principle. No, to the letter of the law. Was he right or wrong? He was wrong. He needed to pay a penalty. Now, if we got in trouble, we would not go and commit suicide. But so I think that there's a mental health issue here that has to be, you know, has to be looked at. I don't think that Carmen Ortiz's husband was right at all. Spouses should stay out of it.
Agree
he should
with
have
that.
Kept his mouth shut.
I should say he
and
tweeted.
I
sort
would
of
not
in
want to be in that
her.
House right now because I can't even imagine the spousal war
I mean, the
going
last
on.
Thing a professional woman needs is a
is
hubby
her husband
weighing,
weighing
you know?
In and trying to but, step in for her. I mean, she truly looked upset yesterday, but she was doing her job. And you can't ever fault anyone for doing their job. Now, should the laws be changed? Listen, there have been intellectual property laws. There have been intellectual property lawyers for years. That's what they do. And, you know, maybe it's something that gets up there. But like Joan said, so what? So now the person who, you know, commits a petty crime is now sitting there saying, well, I'm not connected to Harvard or MIT. I don't know anyone. So I'm on the hook for 6 months. And, you know, now they're all out there about this.
I'm the only one of the three people here who's not a lawyer, although I have two daughters, so I can play a lawyer on TV. The question of whether there was an overcharge here is one, as a non-lawyer, that I look at and say, and it was just written about today, I think that potentially stealing an election, is a much bigger crime. And
that's
she
judgment.
Made a judgment. She made a judgment. And my point to you is, you say she to the fullest extent of the law. No, that's not what they do at all. They go in and they make these decisions
well,
all the
six,
time.
4 to 6 months in jail is not the fullest extent.
That is not
of
the fullest
law.
Exactly.
Extent at
that,
all.
That was just my point.
And, right.
But I'm saying to you, if you think you're innocent, should you, in return for potentially going to jail 30 years, be forced to take a penalty that you don't think you deserve?
No one thinks they're guilty.
Drug dealer doesn't think he's guilty. The guy who has the illegal gun, the guy who beats his wife, no one thinks that they're guilty. Sal DeMacy exactly was out there for how long saying that he wasn't guilty?
He didn't say he wasn't guilty. My argument with you two is...
He said he wasn't guilty.
No. I'm saying when this kid... Oh, I'm not talking about Sal.
He said he was not a felon because he was acting on principle.
And
he gave the information
and
stuff
I,
back.
And,
exactly. So you think
he
didn't that everyone should
anything?
Have drugs? You're acting on principle? I mean,
no,
is that going to be the defense from now on?
I think
that's
that you
a riot.
Use good judgment. And when someone doesn't have a financial gain, which he didn't, that you make a judgment. I would have had no problem with a heavy fine for this thing to penalize him. But to send someone to jail who you know, and she admitted yesterday, she knew had a mental health issue. It just seems to me, with all due respect,
with all due respect, I'm guessing that there are thousands of people in jail with mental health issues.
Absolutely, nowhere else to put them.
Yep.
Well, this debate will go on, and it's amazing how it has erupted in the wake of his suicide. We're going to come back in just a minute and keep talking with Boston Globe columnist Joan Vernachie, former Massachusetts Republican Party Chair Jennifer Nassour, and Michael Goldman from the political consulting firm Goldman & Associates. Up next, it's Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, a lighter turn on takes from the news on the week. I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio, and it's time for Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, where we ask our panelists for their pithy takes on the week's news. Our panelists today are former Massachusetts Republican Party Chair Jennifer Nassour, Michael Goldman, President of Goldman & Associates, and Boston Globe columnist Joan Vernachie. And Joan Vernachie, let me start with you. Did you watch the Lance Armstrong-Oprah interview?
No, I did not. I stuck with HGTV. Sorry about that.
Any viewers of here of Lance Armstrong?
You know, I got to be honest with you. I was going to watch it. I came within an inch. And then I said, why do I want to even give him the rating points when essentially, I know because of everything that was on before that the guy was going to say, yeah, I was a pathological liar for the last 12 years, and I'm sorry I sued. You talk about abuse of the courts. He literally took people to court to sue them because they said he did what he now admitted he's going to do. I hope people sue him for the next 40 years. I mean, I hope they get back all the money he took from them.
Didn't finish or did you watch it?
No, I did
this
not.
This is an 0-for-3. It was incredible. I was watching a little bit last night, and there was so much live tweeting during it. So I'm going to do it here, an unexpected thumbs up, thumbs down. Thumbs up if you know what channel the OWN network, the Oprah Winfrey network, is on your television. Thumbs down from Jennifer Nisour. Thumbs up, thumbs down.
Thumbs down.
Thumbs down. No, nobody knows where it is. Well, that might explain why you... Well, you didn't watch it, but in essence, he admitted to using testosterone, cortisone, right, human growth hormone, and a blood booster. And he said his regime, Michael Goldman, was pretty low-key, and he wasn't the leader.
I know, allegedly, there are many people out there who like him. He did stuff on cancer. But to me, he is about as despicable a person as I can imagine. You know, there are people who work their whole lives to have a single instant of athletic fame. I had no skill at that level. Certainly, I don't care about biking at all. I wouldn't care about it. He raised my awareness of it, so that's good for biking. But when I think of all the other guys who played it straight, he went one of those races, I think, about a half a second. Well, one of those a half. So who, the number two guy who lost by a half a second to a cheat, I mean... I guess
he claims they were all cheating, though, doesn't he?
Yeah. So let's actually do another thumbs down here. Joan Vinaki, thumbs up or thumbs down? Do you have any sympathy for Lance Armstrong, who apparently was not the ringleader of the doping?
Thumbs down. I have no sympathy for him.
Down. Like I just
thumbs down.
Okay, moving right
tough
along.
Tough crowd.
It is a tough crowd.
Sorry, no one likes to cheat.
Not a good crowd for Lance Armstrong. Okay. Looking at business here, one of the things that we found out this week from Apple is that they've had to curtail their ordering of the iPhone 5. So, Jennifer Nisour, thumbs up, thumbs down on Apple. What's your take on where Apple's going here?
I don't know. I think if you produce something and you're out there selling it and people are buying it, then you have to keep producing it. I don't think you stop.
Well, is Apple a product, or are Apple products things that you're buying in your house, things that people want in your house, or do they think, I want the Samsung Galaxy?
No, I have little kids that are completely, you know, like, oh my goodness, that's the new Apple phone. I want to see that. And mommy, when are you getting the new iPhone 5? Right. I mean, that's kind of the culture that we live in right now.
Okay. So it's still a thumbs up in your house.
Yeah. Yeah, I admitted before that I'm just awful at this stuff, and I've made a commitment for 2013 to actually start to listen to you more, Kara, because you do these really interesting stories that pique my attention about this, and I mean that seriously. But I'm a big free, believe it or not, as a liberal Democrat, I'm a big free enterprise guy, and if Apple doesn't want to produce, well, someone else will. Someone will fill that void, and I think you make a mistake when you have the marketplace. Why? I don't. Maybe you could explain to me why they'd even want to not produce.
Well, we will bring you into the innovation world in 2013.
You.
And shameless, terrible plug here. Innovation Hub is going to be on tomorrow at 10 a.m. First time in that slot. So listen.
Oh,
and actually, there's going to be a personal tech review for 2013. Like, what are the gadgets you should have? Anyway, I digress. Back to Joan Vinaki. How is Apple doing in your house?
3 out of 4 have iPhones. I'm not one of them. And 50% of them have Apple laptops.
Okay.
But in terms of, you know, Apple and its future, I do think you can price yourself out of the market, and that it does leave openings for competitors to come in with products that, you know, may not have the total cachet of Apple. But if they're under that high price, you know, people will take a look at them. Not everybody feels that they, you know, have to have the absolute, you know,
right,
top of the line mm-hmm. stuff.
Okay.
Can I just ask a quick question? Since you just did it, how many people know what the Regency product was?
I don't know.
Thumbs silence. Is this what
yeah,
is this about?
Radio
is
silence.
Is this a typewriter?
No, the Regency was the first the first transistor radio when I was a kid.
There we go.
They made the first pocket transistor radio, and they did it because the large companies were still using tubes, and they didn't want. And look what You know, we had a revolution.
Michael, you are the perfect example of the difference between the Republican Party right now and the Democratic Party, okay?
Okay. A few quick takes here. Thumbs up if you feel safe driving through Boston tunnels after all 2,800 reflective panels are being taken off in the Callahan Tunnel. Jennifer Nestor, thumbs up. You feel safe?
I don't feel safe driving around Boston in tunnels or out of tunnels.
Absolutely safe. They took them down. They didn't have to. They did it anyway. A smart thing to do. But it goes to show how bad the infrastructure really is.
Joan Bonacchi.
I felt less safe when there was water gushing in the tunnel. At least they appeared to be dry at the moment.
So thumbs up on relative safety. Yeah, okay. Right. So thumbs up, Jennifer Nestor, if you support Belmont High School breathalyzing students at high school dances. What do you think? Thumbs up?
Listen, you're not supposed to drink when you're under 21 years old. And so I think that it's up to the school to decide. If they don't want drunk kids puking on principal's wives' shoes, then
I was going to say it. And that has happened at Belmont High School. Good call.
I got to be honest with you. As a father of two daughters who are now adults, one of whom is about to have a baby, I'm in favor of that stuff. I think that that kids, if they go to a public event, like a school event, the school has the responsibility to make sure they're not drunk. Because God knows if they get injured having drunk at that event and you didn't do anything, the city's going to get sued. So
yeah, and thumbs up on people who are about to have babies. Okay.
Well, thank you.
I'm okay with it. And I have news for Jen. You may want to have one in your back door of your house because I, like, as the mother of a teenage daughter, I've sometimes wondered about that.
My daughters, when they were teens, never drank.
Okay, a couple more. Thumbs up, thumbs down on the NRA's new smartphone app, originally for those 4 and up, now for those 12 and up. It's called NRA Practice Range, which simulates target shooting practice and has been approved. What do you think, Jennifer Nestor?
Totally thumbs down. There is no way you can prevent those things that say from 12 and up or anything and up to get into kids' hands.
You know, again, it goes to show how to step they are with this country right now, particularly after the tragedy. You would have thought they would have pulled it for six months.
Not smart.
Insane.
Agreed.
This may be my favorite one of the week. Thumbs up, thumbs down on a software developer who earned 6 figures and decided he was going to outsource his job to China. His employer did not know this. So he was on Facebook and Reddit all day, and he paid the Chinese worker a fifth of his salary. What do you think, Jennifer Nestor? Does this sound like a career for you?
You know, it's hysterical that someone would do that. I'm not really sure where I am. I mean, thumbs up for him being so smart to actually think of it, right? Thumbs down on American society that we got so lazy and pathetic that we're outsourcing a job so we could be on Facebook all day.
Well, if that's the concern, being on Facebook, I can hear that. But you know, we outsource jobs, you know, when we have people come in and clean our houses. You know, you could do it for free yourself, or you could have somebody come in. I'll tell you, I read that story. I didn't see it before it was on the list, Kara. And I got to tell you, that's pretty damn smart.
So you're going to be looking into whether there can be political consultants in China.
China or in India. Somewhere a guy could do my job, talk to reporters, be great, you know?
Okay.
Well, you know, thumbs up. He's only doing what the big companies are doing. He just figured out how to make it very personal and helpful to him.
Are you looking into column writers in Bangalore?
No, that I'm not.
And one final one here. Thumbs up, thumbs down on a business idea. I'll start with you, Joan Bonacchi. By two Serbian men. It's called Rage Room. It's you pay an entry fee to go in and hit discarded household things like couches and chairs with a metal bat, and you hope to feel better afterwards. And this is, by the way, taking off for them. Would you go into the Rage Room? Thumbs up, thumbs down, Joan Bonacchi.
No, I'd rather just go to boot camp.
I would not go to the Rangers myself, but I'm a big free enterprise guy. If they can make money, even for a short time, good luck to them.
You know, I'm with Joan. I like going to box. That's how I get rid of it. But, sure. I mean, I think if they have a business idea and people go, good for them.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, this could make for some really good YouTube videos. That's all I'm going to say. So that's going to do it for Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down. We've been talking with Joan Bonacchi, a Boston Globe columnist, Michael Goldman from Goldman & Associates, and Jennifer Nestor, former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party. Great panel. Thank you very much, everybody.
Didn't get to talk about Tiger Woods. Oh,
would you like to say something about Tiger Woods?
I think that's the greatest deal in the world.
You better tell people what the deal is.
Essentially, he wants to remarry her, but she's asking for a prenup of $350 million?
$200 million. $200 million. She can probably make it work
right,
with
whatever,
that.
Whatever. Yeah. $200 million if he cheats. Man, I would do that in another second. And well, then I'd hope he cheated.
Let's put it this way, Michael Goldman. If Elin Nordgren doesn't go for it, we'll point him to you. Okay. Edgar Herwick is in
hey,
the studio.
Kara, this is a lively discussion going on here on
it
Boston Public Radio.
It could go on forever and ever,
it's,
really.
It could. So thumbs up, thumbs down is that kind of a thing. I want to play a little music for you here, Kara. This is very dramatic music. So this is from a film which is called A Royal Affair. Have you heard of this movie?
I have not.
See, most people haven't. And it's nominated for an Oscar. It's a foreign language film nominated for an Oscar. And in a second, we're going to talk with the guy who is behind the Cape Ann Cinema. One of the things that they're doing between now and the Oscars is showing a whole bunch of Oscar films from, like, documentary shorts, animated shorts, foreign films, the stuff that's down on the bill. So if you want to really be ready to kill at your Oscar party and win... You're gonna check this out.
Cool,
coming up.
The yeah. things you never get to see.
Yes, yeah. Yes, it's true.
Sounds
it's
exciting. True. I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Edgar B. Herwick III, and this is Boston Public Radio.